Music has a special way of touching our hearts in ways many things cannot. And if you're tuning into this podcast, you probably think so too. On each episode of Classical Post, we uncover a creative mind behind music we find particularly exceptional. Coming to you from New York, Classical Post is created and produced by Gold Sound Media, a marketing and PR agency for the performing arts industry. I'm your host, Jonathan Eifert, creative director at Gold Sound Media, and I hope you find something inspiring in this episode. A postmodern take on Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, Yorgos Lanthimos' new film, Poor Things, sees the director exploring ideas of life and liberty in his uniquely surrealist way. The movie revolves around Bella, played by Emma Stone, a woman in Victorian Britain brought back to life by Dr. Godwin Baxter, played by Willem Dafoe. Eager to learn more about the world around her, Bella sets off on a fantastical globe-hopping adventure. That theme of reanimation was central to composer Druskin Fendricks while developing the film's score. Although he's primarily known as a singer, pianist, and songwriter active in South London's indie music scene, Fendricks' ability to merge his classical training with experimental approaches to music making was a perfect fit for the world of Poor Things. To match the imaginative tone of Lanthimos' film, Druskin spent time digitally processing and manipulating the voice of each instrument, ultimately transforming even the most familiar musical sounds into an unfamiliar, almost eerie listening experience. In this episode, Fendricks and I talk more about the creative process behind his Poor Things score. Plus, he shares a piece of writing advice from Kurt Vonnegut that helps him focus his work, the importance of emotional resonance in his music, and the street food scene he craves whenever he's in New York City. Poor Things and the film's official soundtrack will be released on December 8th. The first two singles, Bella and Lisbon, are available wherever you stream music.
Hi, my name is Druskin Fendricks. I'm a film composer. I've just written the score for Yorgos Lanthimos' new feature, Poor Things. I also write songs and do other things musically.
Where do you find inspiration to create music, but not in the music world itself, but something outside of it?
Yeah, this is actually just, easier than one would expect. I really prefer non-musical stuff. I was raised in the countryside. I really adore farms and woods. Specifically, and animals, general English countryside sort of dwelling things. I had a very academic-y, theologically sort of upbringing. So I find literature always really interesting, but I love researching anything that it's appropriate to in that sort of way. I also spend a lot of time in church, and I think I'm very moved by a lot of the artistic things that happen in church as well as music. Yeah, that seems like a reasonable amount of things to be inspired by.
I like jokes.
Jokes are good. I like jokes and I like smells. I like jokes and smells. That'll do. Yeah.
If we, though, dig into the creative industries a little bit more for inspiration and talk about art, like painting, sculpture, that sort of thing, or design, any of the design fields, architecture, fashion, film, do any of those kind of industries, inspire you when you're actually writing the music?
Not much of what you mentioned, to be honest. A lot of my tastes are quite pedestrian. I really like Picasso, Hundert Wasser, Gaudi, Van Gogh, all these people. But overall, I think literature is a really big part of it. I think Shakespeare has been a big part of my upbringing. I also really like John Berryman. Those two are fairly solid pillars. I'm very interested in fashion. I find it fascinating. You could argue it's inspiration in the sense that I'm interested in it. And I like that it's a universe that has a language that I really don't particularly understand. And that makes it all the more alluring. And I don't know if I utilize it.
Yeah. Oh, fascinating though, nonetheless. To describe a routine you have in place that helps you live a healthier life.
I do not live a healthy life. I have no routines in place to ensure that I do. It's just endless, endless work. I'm being 100% serious.
Hey, why not? I'm smiling just because most people, you know, have something. They say the opposite of what you just said. That's why I'm laughing. Forgive me.
No, please do.
If we talk though about energy, do you have something that gives you energy to keep being creative?
There was a great bit of writing advice by Kurt Vonnegut, very important American author of the latter half-ish of the 20th century. And he said to always write with someone in mind. If you try and write something with the view to please everyone, it's like making love to an open window. And I've always thought that's phenomenal advice for any level of artist. And anytime I write a piece of music, I can pretty confidently say this, I will have the ghost of a friend or a lover or a family member, living or dead, beside me in some capacity who I will know that they will really love how dumb that the choice of instrument is, or will be really moved by this harmonic sequence. That's where I derive the energy from. The kind of work I do necessitates a great deal of isolated time, but I really have that company with me always when I'm writing.
What restaurant or bar do you love to eat at when you're in New York City? And then obviously, what do you order there?
I think the thing about New York, which really sets it aside from a great number of Western cities, is how high level the street food is. So I really try and opt for getting pizza most of the time. I really love doing that. There was a great place in Greenpoint called Ashbox that did really good onigiri. I don't know if that still exists. Bars, they're good. Yeah, bars are interesting. It's a shame about the lack of pubs in general. Pebble Bar is cool. You had a venue called Silent Barn in Williamsburg, which shut down. And Silent Barn was so good. I was so unhappy to hear that it had run out of money over COVID and had to shut. I think that's what happened anyway. We have a venue which is a really similar analog in London called The Windmill in Brixton. And that's such an important part of culture and the music scene in London. And I've never felt a place seem more of an analog to that than Silent Barn did. So yeah, that was a real shame.
Let's pause for a second. Are you an artist or work at an arts organization? I founded Gold Sound Media to help you expand your audience through social media. My team and I work closely with clients around the United States, directly shaping their messaging through customized strategic content. One of our biggest success stories is our work for the Clyburn, where we drove 25 million viewers, making it one of the most watched classical music events of all time. Get in touch to speak with me directly about how Gold Sound Media can help you. Just head to goldsoundmedia.com. Now, back to the show. So congrats on the score and writing this incredible music for Poor Things. I had the privilege of seeing a screening of it early in prep for interviewing you today. And it was fascinating, you know, to watch, obviously, the film, but then to hear your work, the music, and how it fit with this kind of unusual film in a way. It wasn't what I was kind of initially expecting, actually. And so I'm curious to hear your take on how you approached this project.
Yeah, it was a really interesting and joyous thing to try and work out what to do with it, because I was brought on very early, about 6 months before shooting started. And I was given the script and I was given all the design stuff, the concept artwork, the production designs, the costume artwork, and so on. And, you know, I don't need too much to go on, to be honest. I can have a pretty low carb diet inspiration wise. And it was so, there were just so many decisions instantly to work out what, which part of, you know, which characters I was interested apart from Bella in, if I wanted to, you know, like how I wanted to play with the aesthetic side of it, how I wanted to play with the emotional side of it, what were the right tools in trying to express this. There was, it often like, I probably, if given the time, I could probably write 2 or 3 more hours of music based on just the script and the artwork. It was so nutritious. So that was the first sort of thing really to try and I settled on in the end, I think, my bottom line for any piece of music, regardless of how bizarrely I chose to orchestrate it or kind of processing or what kind of provocation I would wanted to put in, I wouldn't let a piece of music go forward unless I thought it was really emotionally resonant. I didn't want anything dishonest. I didn't want anything that wasn't raw and embarrassingly open about how Bella would be feeling at any part of the film, regardless of how stupid the music sounded. As long as the emotional impact was there, it went.
That's fascinating. You talk about emotional impact, because I get where you're going with that. Because when I was sitting there listening and watching, you had that motif. It was like that super growling, kind of deep bass. I don't even know what the if it was some sort of synthesizer or something, but it had this deep like growl all the time. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, the way in which I chose to produce this soundtrack was to record every instrument totally separately. We never had more than one musician in a room at any given point. And what that gave me was the freedom to process everything to my heart's content. We played a lot with pitch alteration, both in like register and also like bending the actual stayed pitch of an instrument, playing with gutting things from a frequency point of view, trying to add things to, with the intent of basically having a sound that was vaguely familiar and kind of gave you the emotional resonance that you get from hearing a familiar instrument or group of instruments, but knowing that there was something kind of like off about it, even if you only recognized it subconsciously. It's like, okay, this is the bassoon I've grown up to know and love, but like there must be something wrong, right? And this is kind of, I think, what any experience of any of the characters in Poor Things must have had with Bella. It's this, you know, someone who's, you know, warm and attractive in a way which people know how to use sociologically and how to respond to. But everyone kind of knows in the film, even if they can't admit it to themselves, like there's, you know, something really unusual and quite sinister is behind what's happening at the moment. So that's what I kind of want to achieve.
You did a brilliant job at that, because talk about the emotional connection, kind of evoking or writing for emotions. As I was watching, and the different ways that the music kind of was weaved in, or even when silence would occur and the lack of music, you know, those spots, I thought that was very interesting too. I'm curious to hear about your process with writing. Was it one of those things where you just read the script and you were writing, or was it this iterative thing where you were seeing some of the scenes captured, viewing it, and then writing to kind of respond? I don't know what that process looks like. I don't know if you can share any of that.
Yeah, I don't really know what other people do, and it'd be fun to know, but I just don't. Most of the music, at least 95% of it, was written without a single scene having been shot. And there was, to some extent, in the editing process, we had to slightly realign some stuff, just like very minute little scalpeling on the timing side. But overall, it was reading and experiencing the script and the art designs, spending a lot of time contemplating it meditatively, doing a bunch of research into what sounds I wanted. I spent a bit of time at the Wellcome Collection, which is a historical medical archive and library in London, which gave me a lot of good pointers. And yeah, the preparation stage is really, you know, the mise en place, if you could call it, I think is sometimes underrated. And if you get that right, then you can have a lot more fun doing the second things, because it's so hard to retroactively try and invent a philosophy or a thematic approach for yourself. So that the beginning stages of really thinking about it were very important. And then I was given the freedom to basically just write abstract compositions based on the feelings I had from the characters, from their experiences, from what was going on cosmetically in the film. And it didn't have to match any cuts formically. It didn't have to be a 2 minute, you know, increase in tension, then a drop and it come up again. I just got to write a really large amount of instrumental music based on how I responded to this artwork, which is, you can't really ask for much more than that in terms of artistic freedom.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, because I was curious as I was listening if this was more of an interaction that you had with any of the actors or the director, or, you know, that you had conversations with Mark Ruffalo or Emma Stone or the director, and then you kind of all like worked together and had feedback, but it sounds like it wasn't the case at all.
No. Yeah. It would be a lie to say that. There was, I mean, Yorgos, you know, he's very humble about what he does, but the way he plans out how to make a film has got a great deal of contemplated mechanism behind it. I think even the order in which people were brought in, I think production design was brought in very, very early. Then costume design was brought in after that. Obviously, this is all after the script, which is brought in very early indeed. Then I'm after the costume and the thing, and then certain people are after that. And then the actors have this environment to play in. They get to not only be in this really lusciously rendered set, as in physically rendered, and with these costumes, but also like the music was being played while they were filming, like in between takes, it was, you know, to achieve this atmosphere. And yeah, it's in some ways seems bizarre and disjointed and kind of difficult to make sense of. But actually, when you look at it in reverse, Yorgos basically knew what he was doing the entire time, as much as one might think that any of his decisions are sort of insane.
Yeah. Going back to kind of how you were distorting the sounds and recording the instruments separately, I find that interesting. And especially on the, you know, the finished product, it really matched the, you know, what the visuals were happening in terms of feeling like you were in an alternate universe in a way. And had you taken, I think, a different approach, you know, where it felt more tonal or felt more, you know, traditional orchestration, it would have been completely different and probably missed the mark entirely. Where I love what you did, because this kind of distorting sounds and creating this, you know, stuff that you can't quite put your finger on matched then the script beautifully. So I'm getting kind of, I understand that a little bit more now. I guess what I was saying earlier is I was surprised that you took that tack, but it makes perfect sense now hearing, you know, your kind of statement about why you did what you did. I don't know if there's any more that you want to say on that kind of sound distorting and kind of coming up with something that you can't quite put your finger on.
Yeah. All right. As a slightly long-winded explanation of one idea, I was really interested in wind and wind instruments and breath as a musical idea, counting the voices, wind in itself, I suppose. And so much of the film revolves around what life is from a biological, medical point of view, and also what life means for you sociologically, and, you know, all these kind of different, you know, a lot of it's basically this really interesting treatise on what are the different ways a life can be. And breath and life are so inextricably tied up. And I was interested in wind instruments that use human breath, like a flute. And you hear a flute bend a bit, and it's great because it sounds a bit like a human voice, and human voices, the way they work, they're just a constant series of fixed pitches that bend enough that it doesn't even sound very musical. When you get wind instruments that do not come from a human mouth and therefore make sense if they talk in a human way and bend in a human way, I'm talking about things like pipe organs, bagpipes, accordions, wind instruments where humans have actually mechanically animated them with their own breath rather than it coming from a living sentient organism. These are often more fixed. They don't have the qualities of human speech. Then when you get something like this, like there are parts of the film where we took a pipe organ and worked out what happens when you start to bend the pitch on that, the impression of something which is not sentient and shouldn't be alive, do it replicating something that is alive, I think sets off a really primal fear-based instinct. I think you get that with anything that's not living that gives the impression that it is alive. It's just something which is, I think, really preternaturally horrifying. So I was really interested in how that would be achieved by basically getting instruments which are reanimated themselves and then trying to get, you know, to marionette them. So that's, yeah, it's one idea, I guess. I've heard a lot of people talk about bits of the score being atonal. public service announcement, almost none of it's atonal. I'm really interested that a lot of people have interpreted parts of the score as dissonant, and especially people who interpret it as atonal, which is partly a semantic thing, because atonal means a really specific thing. But actually, a lot of the score is very tonal in its composition and very diatonic and actually pretty simple. And I'm really interested in the disjunct that's faced by listeners when they hear something which part of their brain realizes should feel normal, but it's presented in a way which is very stark or very confrontational or difficult or unpleasantly textured. And it's like a normal, it's like a straight non-atonal piece of music, but it's given to them on this really, in a way which I think is difficult to comprehend. And the fact that it can't be interpreted like that, and a lot of people have moved to atonal, I'm really happy about, because it means that I'm kind of making people feel dysmorphia about the music, which is kind of, you know, a cool thing to achieve, I guess.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Classical Post. If you loved it, give us a 5-star review, as it helps us reach more people. Also, remember to hit that follow button in your podcast app to get notified of new episodes.